Governor Ducey unveils his budget this afternoon, explaining how he plans to close more than a $1 billion deficit. It probably won't win him any popularity contests.
It's your job to make a lot of people angry, because if you spread the pain out, you're going to have a lot of people mad at you.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, Copper's Wild Week. A southern Arizona town could get a new border crossing if it foots the bill.
The state is gaining venture capital momentum.
And a local band embraces its new material.
Once we started working on them, we just kind of fell in love with them and massaged them and nurtured them to the point where they are now.
Plus, changes in children's health and government going digital.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. And good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Looks like we'll have a sunny, warm weekend around the valley. For tomorrow, look for a high of 74 degrees, and then by Sunday, up to 77. Currently, it's mostly sunny. Relative humidity is at 20%, and we're at 70 degrees. In valley traffic, a couple of accidents to watch out for. The most troubling one is the 202 eastbound at the 101. That one's blocking the right lane. And there's also an accident 101 eastbound at 7th Avenue.
Football helmets for professional, collegiate, and high school athletes will now have to be tested by a third party in order to certify they meet safety standards. Previously, equipment suppliers certified their own products. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan reports the details of that change were announced today at an industry conference in Phoenix.
The National Operating Committee on Standards for Athletic Equipment sets the rules for how to test helmets for safety. The standards are required by professional, college, and high school governing bodies. By November, football, lacrosse, and baseball helmets will have to go through the third-party certification and audit process to assure the helmets meet the safety requirements. Mike Oliver is the director of the standards organization.
We just decided it was necessary. We wanted to make sure that our standards maintained integrity. We wanted to make sure that when a mom or a dad or a player saw the logo on the helmet, they could have a high level of confidence that, in fact, the helmet's going to do what it's supposed to do.
The Safety Equipment Institute is the third party that will test and approve the equipment. It certifies protective gear for firefighters, industrial clothing, and other products. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
A wrongful death lawsuit stemming from the deaths of 19 firefighters in the 2013 Yarnell Hill fire may be paused because the state and victim survivors have agreed to take part in mediation, a step toward a possible settlement. Lawyers for the sides today asked a U.S. District Court judge to put the court case on hold for now. Their joint motion said Arizona's Workplace Safety Agency has also agreed to take part in so-called global mediation.
Governor Doug Ducey is unveiling his budget at this hour. It's expected to detail how he plans to fill in an approximately $500 million gap in the current year's budget and around a $1 billion deficit in the fiscal year starting in July. Joined by GOP legislative leaders, Ducey spoke with reporters earlier today before the release.
This budget doesn't just give the appearance of spending discipline. It offers the reality of spending discipline with decisions that are real, timely, and permanent. Arizona families and small businesses have all had to make tough decisions. Government is no different.
So what's the budget going to look like? Over the last couple of weeks, we've spoken to a few people who have good insight into that, the incoming chair of the House Appropriations Committee, Justin Olson, and that panel's former chair, John Kavanaugh. He now serves as vice chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee. Olson says lawmakers have to take on the problem head on.
We need to get down to the brass tacks and make sure that we actually balance the budget once and for all, so that we can then continue to grow and we don't have to continue to come back session after session after session and address deficits because we papered over the last year's deficit with one-time solutions.
While there will most certainly be spending cuts, Kavanaugh says that's not all the budget will include.
I think you'll see the universities taking a fairly significant hit this time because we do give them about $800 million. And you're going to have to see some of the gimmicks because you just can't cut that much from state government and have any state government left.
Kavanaugh says even if lawmakers tried to do that, it still wouldn't balance the budget.
If we were to cut 10% from all levels of state government, except K-12 because of a lawsuit, and except Child Protective Services because of all the problems they have, but everybody else, including corrections, we knock off 10%, we only save about $150 million, and we have a $1 billion shortfall.
But Justin Olson says if lawmakers and the governor reduced new spending and went back to last year's spending level, that'd go a long way toward closing the gap.
It really is possible to balance this budget, to do it with no new taxes and no new debt without creating a substantial reduction in services.
But that still leaves the question, how exactly did we get here? To try to get to the bottom of that, we turn to Jim Round, Senior Vice President with Scottsdale-based Elliott D. Pollock & Company.
We went through a really tough recession, and what people are forgetting is that this recession hit Arizona disproportionately compared to a lot of other states. So we had that bridge on that sales tax. And what's interesting is that when things are really bad, it gives people the excuse to look at every option possible to balance the budget. And you can demonstrate there are no other options. And that's what they did last time during the downturn. So now we don't have that, and we're still being impacted by this particular downturn. We're going to be in 6 years in economic recovery this coming summer. So a very long expansion, but it's been really weak here. So it's really more economic than it is just what's happening down at the state capitol. They have an environment which they have to work within, but a lot of that's dictated by the national economy.
So are things bad enough that cuts will need to happen, but not so bad that lawmakers will be talking about tax increase? I mean, they haven't been talking about tax increases. So are we sort of in that middle ground?
Yeah, we're exactly in that middle ground. And here's what they probably need to consider doing. So they're faced with a budget deficit that everybody's heard, $500 million now this year, and then another billion next year. And then depending on how they fix it, it may be ongoing. If they just deal with one-time fixes for this year and next, we're going to have deficits that will continue. So they're going to have to look at some permanent fixes as well. So we have two things going on. We have that $1.5 billion. They have some rainy day fund money that they could apply. It's not raining outside, but it's foggy enough, at least in our state, where they could use that money. We're probably going to see some additional economic growth above and beyond what's being used in the budget forecast, because when they're doing their job, they should have a conservative forecast. That's just how it normally works in an expansion. So let's say they get another $250 million bucks, at least $750 million that they have to find. It is hard to get that amount of money when you have so much of the budget that you really can't touch. It's not as bad as it was before, but I think there might be fewer options than there were before.
Given the importance of overall economic growth to the health of the state budget, is it too soon to say whether or not some of the things that the state has done over the past couple of years to try to grow the economy are working?
Yeah, and I know that the policymakers and actually a lot of people have been getting questions about that. Unfortunately, there's no way of completely separating how one particular policy action could affect the economy, because we have so many huge things impacting the economy, like the inability of people to get mortgages, the fact that businesses are still having a little bit of a hard time getting loans, money really isn't moving. That is going to mask some of the stuff that the state has done. The next 2 years really should be the year about how do we figure out what to do once we get past this budget deficit issue. But above everything, above all the economic issues, above all the education and highways and all the other stuff, balancing the budget is the number one thing that they have to take care of.
Do you think it's fair to say that the budget that the governor is releasing today will have something that just about everybody can dislike?
I hope so. When you're dealing with a pretty significant deficit, and you need to first look at where the government can become more efficient and maybe pull spending back a little bit, it's your job to make a lot of people angry, because if you spread the pain out, you're going to have a lot of people mad at you.
Jim Rounds is Senior Vice President with Elliott D. Pollock & Company. We'll have details on Governor Ducey's budget during All Things Considered. How do you get disaffected voters re-engage with politics? Could e-government be the answer? Estonian leaders think so. They say digital is, quote, woven into the fabric of government and democracy.
And as one official puts it, in the future, Estonia will be so paper-free that the, quote, only place you'd use it would be in the restroom. But to operate at this digital level, all citizens have an identity card, something which is a bit of a problem in some countries, including the U.S. The BBC's Chris Morris reports from the Estonian capital.
It's a damp, cold, almost misty day, and I'm standing outside the painted pink and white facade of the Estonian Parliament here in Tallinn. Everything looks very traditional, but this is in fact one of the most digital societies in the world, and that's something that extends into politics.
103,000.
So this was the European elections?
Yes, yeah.
More than 100,000 people
voted online.
Voted online.
Yeah. Let me see whether we can see anything.
Kalav Peel, the CEO of a local technology company, says it's more interactive than postal voting. If a campaign debate or a meeting persuades you, you can log back on and change your vote.
Yeah, you can vote as many times as you want in the electronic.
You can change your mind.
Yeah, over the 1 week period, basically, you can vote. I think that it's better than the mailman, definitely.
And e-politics is taking over inside Parliament as well. All debates and committee meetings are available online via text or video, and you can track the detail of legislation in real time.
Okay, so you can see what kind of changes gone through, what kind of proposals somebody did, and so on and so on. It comes very quickly.
It's not a paperless Parliament yet, but that is a long-term ambition. And for MPs like Lisa Pacosta, the most important thing about e-politics is that it's a two-way street.
We are so reachable to the people. Via Facebook, via Twitter, we get comments on laws, we get amendments directly online. Yeah, people are working together with us and we are really working for people. I can work from home, I can do amendments from my travel.
Do you think it is making a difference to people's engagement with politics?
Of course, it's a very easy way to get better legislation. It really helps us to make the laws better.
Voting numbers, though, in many countries in Eastern Europe aren't great, are they? They're quite low. Is this one of the ways you hope to sort of re-energise political participation? And do you think it will work?
It works a little bit. The numbers could be much higher, but still we have responses from the public that, especially for young people, it's just an easy way to say what they think.
It's hardly surprising that it's the younger generation, like students here at the Tallinn University of Technology, that's embraced Estonia's digital revolution most enthusiastically. They love the convenience of having thousands of public and private services available at the click of a mouse. But, and here's the controversial bit from a British perspective, it's all based around a national ID card scheme and a digital identity given to every citizen at birth. Jakob Irve is a professor here at the university.
When I read about Brits being afraid of national identity card, they are throwing so much away.
Well, you've got your card in your hand here. Yeah. I mean, what can you do with it?
I can do most of dealings with Estonian government, so I can be anywhere in the world. That's incredibly convenient.
And do you think it makes government more approachable, politics more approachable?
Yes, it does. We will find security issues with this card. But I think that since Estonians have seen how convenient it is, these are more like things that we'd like to fix.
So here in the corridors of power, Estonia's digital revolution appears not to be hampered by the kind of privacy concerns expressed elsewhere in Europe. If you buy into that idea, even foreigners can now apply for an Estonian e-residency from, well, anywhere. And for locals, the e-objectives are pretty clear. To make life a little simpler, and when it comes to politics, to make it a bit more accessible for the people.
That's the BBC's Chris Morris in Estonia. A pair of new reports released this morning detail the impact families have felt from the loss of the Kids Care health care program for low-income families. Last year, Arizona became the only state in the country to not have a children's health insurance or CHIP program. All the budget cuts led to an enrollment freeze in 2009.
3 years later, a group of hospitals pooled their resources to draw down federal money in a program called Kids Care 2. Joe Fu, health policy director for Children's Action Alliance, says there were about 37,000 kids enrolled when the program ended a year ago. Of those, around 23,000 were automatically enrolled in Medicaid, but about 14,000 lost coverage right away.
Currently, it's unknown, you know, where these children ended up, but this study recently by Georgetown basically outlines that what happened is a lot of families floundered. Some of them made it onto their employer insurance. Some may have considered the marketplace or the Affordable Care Act exchanges, and others, their income may have been reduced or cut, and they are back on Medicaid itself.
So this report released this morning sort of looks at some of the economic impacts of those kids losing their coverage. What did they find?
Really, what we found was that families really struggled. They were unprepared for the end of kids care, despite the state doing some efforts to notify them. Families were really unprepared, and what resulted was that they floundered to find coverage for their kids shortly after they lost health coverage. And as a result of that, unfortunately, children went without the necessary health care they need to, you know, go to school and lead, you know, really productive, healthy lives.
So what do we do about this?
So there are a couple of things that we can do. On one hand, our nationally elected leaders need to work together to really reauthorize the Children's Health Insurance Program, because that's up for reauthorization soon in Congress. But locally, we would call on elected leaders and healthcare leaders to work with us to chart a path at least towards the restoration of kids care. We understand that it might not be tomorrow that we get this done, but at least begin to chart that path forward.
Given the fact that the last iteration of kids care came about not through the legislature and the governor, but by hospitals getting together to draw down federal money, how optimistic can you reasonably be that this will happen?
I think there's, you know, with a new group of leaders and fresh thoughts and thinking and leadership at our state, we can certainly get it done. I think that there's a precedence in that 49 other states in the country have this program, and it has shown to be not only a successful program for kids and their health, but also it's a successful federal and state partnership. It's a successful private and public partnership, because the plans that these kids are on are private plans. And not only that, but families have skin in the game too. They pay a premium. This is a program that has shown to be tremendously successful at reducing the rate of uninsured kids all across the U.S.
Do you think this would be a situation where the state would come up with the money, or do you think what Kids Care 2 became with private entities coming together with money, is that the model you're mostly looking at now?
You know, there are several options. We do know that with reauthorization of the Children's Health Insurance Program, there's certainly an opportunity for the federal government to contribute many more matching dollars than before.
Joe Fu is the Director of Health Policy for Children's Action Alliance. Still to come, copper prices went way down this week, then went way up. What does that mean for Arizona's industry?
At what point do the copper prices get so low that mines either can't afford to operate or pull back, saying we're going to shut down or just lay everybody off temporarily?
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. Valley weather for tonight. It should be clear and dry with lows in the upper 40s to lower 50s. And then this weekend, sunny and dry with a high of 74 tomorrow, warming to 77 degrees on Sunday. Currently with relative humidity at 20%, mostly sunny and 70 degrees here at 91.5. In Valley traffic, a cluster of accidents in the North Valley. I-17 southbound at Greenway, I-17 northbound at Union Hills, and if you're on the 101 eastbound, look out for a collision at 7th Avenue blocking the shoulder.
KJZZ is supported by Seton Catholic Preparatory, serving for 60 years as the only Catholic college prep high school in the East Valley. More information at setoncatholic.org. Academic excellence, a world of opportunity.
President Obama is pushing Congress to require employers to offer their workers up to 7 days of paid sick leave per year. Last week, we talked about how many Americans go to work when they're sick and the impacts on both public health and productivity. Faro Quinlan is Arizona director of the National Federation of Independent Business, which represents small businesses.
No one opposes paid sick leave per se, but the business should be able to respond to the needs of their workers and to the market based on their circumstances. Certain companies, regardless of size, because of keeping good employees and all of that, have to provide certain benefits. But for the government to do a one-size-fits-all throughout the economy really puts certain businesses at a real disadvantage, and it actually will probably hurt employment even more than it will help the individual workers.
What are some of the different ways that different kinds of businesses handle this kind of thing?
Well, a lot of small businesses don't get paid unless they do the work. So if a worker is not working and they're out sick, they're not actually producing the receivables for the company. So if they're going to be paid for work that's not being done because they're not available to do it, that becomes a real problem for certain types of businesses that depend on getting paid only after they perform a service for their clients.
What does the cost-benefit analysis look like when small businesses are saying, okay, we need to get paid for the work, but on the other hand, employee X doesn't feel well and maybe isn't going to do the work well and could also get the rest of our workforce sick and then potentially cost us more money?
Well, these aren't new issues. I mean, most companies have policies about if you're sick, you shouldn't show up for work, and that's understood. In fact, coming into work when you're sick probably is going to make your sickness last longer, and your productivity is going to be lessened. So employers have no incentive to have somebody who's sick come in and infect the entire workplace or actually extend the amount of time the worker is going to be less productive. So I think there's a lot of assuming here that that employers aren't responding to the needs of their workers. That's what they do every single day. They're responding to the needs and the signals they get from the marketplace, and they're responding to the very same things they get from their workers.
Are there different ways that different kinds of businesses can give their workers sick time and have those workers still get paid for? Because I think that for a lot of workers, that's a big consideration. They maybe don't want to go to work, but also need to get paid for the day. So are there different ways that different industries can handle giving their workers paid sick time absent the federal government?
Oh, of course. And I think that's the key to it. There needs to be greater flexibility in things like flex time, overtime, being able to work with an employee. If an employee usually works 5 days a week and they're sick a couple days and they want to work an extra day that they normally don't, or they want to make it up in some other way, stay an extra shift, they should have that flexibility. But a lot of the wage laws that we have on the books imposed on us from the federal government make that very hard and, in fact, some ways illegal, or they make it so that it's so expensive because it'll trigger certain kinds of overtime rules and things like that. It doesn't really allow the business to respond to the needs of the individual employee as well.
Farrell Quinlan is Arizona State Director of the National Federation of Independent Business. It's been an up-and-down week for one of Arizona's five C's. Copper fell to a five-year low on Wednesday and then rebounded the next day, posting its biggest one-day percentage gain in 4 months. At last check, copper is up again today. For more on what's been going on, we turn to Lee Allison. He's Arizona State Geologist and Director of the Arizona Geological Survey.
It's hard to understand exactly what's behind this. There's talk about a slowdown in the Chinese economy. There's talk about tying it back to oil prices and fear of global recession. But I think the wild swings indicate that some of this is based on uncertainty rather than real hard numbers.
Are copper prices usually more stable than this? Obviously, they're more stable than the biggest drop and biggest gain. But how are they generally?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. It's not as volatile as some other commodities because copper is it's not so much a precious metal. It's one you use in construction and economic development. And it's interesting if you go back over, say, the last 25 or 30 years, copper really ran between probably around 75 cents a pound and up to maybe $1.50, and it stayed in that range for 15, 20 years. And then in 2004, we started to see a fairly dramatic increase. 2005, we started seeing record prices, and really in 2006 is when it got up over $3 a pound. But then starting with the recession 4 or 5 years ago, we've seen a general long, slow decline in copper prices, not dramatic, but still staying in the $2.50 to $3.50 per pound range. And then it's just been in over this last year, we've seen a very dramatic drop. And then in the last few days, a huge one. So the kind of jumping around we're seeing right now is very unusual for copper.
What kind of impact, if any, does all that have on Arizona?
Well, Arizona is the largest copper producer in the U.S. It's one of the top five in the world, and Arizona supplies approximately two-thirds of all the copper used in the U.S., not just mined in the U.S., but used in the U.S. That has a huge economic impact because there's something over 11,000, close to 12,000 mining jobs in Arizona, and a large number of those are related to copper production. But for every one of those jobs, there's a support position, or people are, you know, buying products, and employees are using that money to pay their bills. And so the indirect impact multiplies that to maybe three times as many people, jobs depending on the income from the mining sector. There's another piece of that, which is we have some of the world's largest mining companies headquartered here in Arizona. So Freeport, McMoRan, ASARCO, Southern Copper. So it's not just Arizona mines, but they work worldwide. And so as the copper price goes down there, that impacts the headquarters and their profits. Plus, the copper industry provides something like $500 million a year in tax revenue to state and local government.
How much volatility in the market, I mean, how much do prices have to swing around, do you think, before we start feeling some of those impacts?
Yeah, there's multiple levels there. We're starting to hear some of the companies holding off on some investments or some expenditures right now while they analyze the situation. One of the questions is, at what point do the copper prices get so low that mines either can't afford to operate or pull back, saying we're going to shut down or just lay everybody off temporarily until things recover? That varies from mine to mine, but I'm seeing numbers in the low $2 range as a general industry base, that when it gets down to $2.30 a pound or lower, that's when analysts are suggesting that some of these mines are going to have to take a very serious look at their operating costs and whether they can continue running.
Lee Allison is the state geologist and director of the Arizona Geological Survey. Lee, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Anytime.
There are only a handful of bands that truly stand the test of time and resonate with fans spanning across the globe and the generations. Bands like the Beatles, the Ronettes, and the Ramones.
Hey!
Longtime drummer for the group and one of its only surviving members, Marky Ramone, wrote a book titled Punk Rock Blitzkrieg, My Life as a Ramone, that came out this week. Sarah Ventry caught up with him about his new memoir, in which he reflects on his life, career, and years spent in the iconic band.
I had the opportunity to observe the other three members in the van for 15 years and 1,700 shows.
And however many tens or even hundreds of thousands of miles. The dynamics of the group are well documented, and it wasn't always pretty. Clashes over politics, creative direction, and even girlfriends were a huge part of life offstage for the band. In his new book, Marky Ramone delves into extraordinarily detailed recounts of the group's adventures and squabbles that later became legendary, like what it was like to record with well-known rock producer Phil Spector.
Well, he never pointed a gun at us in the studios. That's just a rumor.
A rumor that was not completely surprising, considering a similar rumor existed about Spector when he produced John Lennon and Leonard Cohen. Marky says Spector never actually pulled a gun on them, but he does say in the book that Spector pulled out two pistols and laid them on the table. Intimidating to some, but not to Marky.
Phil was a very unusual person, and of course with a huge ego, but he was the greatest producer America had, rock producer. So we were very grateful to work with him, but along with that came, you know, all the craziness. I mean, we as the Ramones weren't your normal people either.
Throughout the book's tales, from humorous to heartbreaking, it's hard to forget that there's a unique sense of loss accompanying each story, because the other most prominent members of the band have all passed away.
Of course, it was emotional because the other three members weren't around anymore. And if I'm going to talk about someone else, I got to talk about myself, too, and what I went through concerning the rehab, two rehabs I was in, and all the craziness that went down in my life.
The craziness that Marky Ramone is referring to includes the 4 years in the mid-'80s when he was asked to leave the band because of his severe alcoholism. After spending time in rehab and getting clean, he rejoined the band in 1987. Marky remained with the band until their breakup in 1996. In 2001, frontman Joey Ramone died of lymphoma, and in the years since, Johnny, Dee Dee, and Tommy Ramone have all passed away as well.
Death is a horrible thing, especially when you die young. I mean, they died too young to enjoy the fruits of their labor. But I find it fun playing the songs, and I see it in the audience that I'm providing them entertainment that they like. If I stopped doing this, I would feel bad not playing those songs. So that's why I continue, because it was always a joy playing them, and it helps perpetuate the memory of the band.
Marky Ramone still plays the Ramones music in his own band, Marky Ramone's Blitzkrieg. And over 35 years later, he couldn't be happier about it. Sarah Ventry, KJZZ News.
Marky Ramone will be in town this Tuesday, January 20th at the Crescent Ballroom in conversation with the Arizona Republic's Ed Masley. Coming up, the Valley's trying to catch up with California on high-tech jobs, but the Golden State has a 100-year head start.
We're really at a crossroads where we can continue to heavily invest in post-secondary institutions, and also the applied research that is really tied to a lot of our legacy industries like aerospace and defense.
Attracting venture capital, that's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. He's Steve. I'm Mark. Checking Valley traffic, I-70 northbound. An accident at Union Hills has the left lanes blocked. Sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon today. Look for clear skies tonight. Overnight lows in the upper 40s. Sunny skies over the weekend as well, with a high of 74 tomorrow and 76 on Sunday. 70 degrees right now under sunny skies at KJZZ at 236.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore of Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership, presenting the new 2015 Subaru Legacy, the midsize sedan redefined. Ready now for test drives. Shop Subaru.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. French, German, and Belgian police arrested more than two dozen suspects in anti-terrorism raids overnight as European authorities work to head off more attacks by people linked to Islamist extremists. Rob Wainwright, the head of the European Union's police agency, says the nature of terrorism has changed and they're now more difficult to stop.
The diffuse nature of the network, the scale of the people involved makes this extremely difficult for even very well-functioning counter-terrorist agencies such as we have in France to stop every attack.
President Obama and British Prime Minister David Cameron are pledging to work together to fight domestic terrorism after the deadly attacks. The two world leaders met today at the White House. Consumer prices posted a large decline in December because of a drop in energy prices. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports the Labor Department says over the year, inflation on all goods and services increased by less than 1%.
Low inflation is attributable to the sharp decline in energy prices. Last month, the consumer price index fell 0.4%, the biggest one-month drop in 6 years. That's largely because gasoline prices dropped more than 9% during the month. Excluding food and energy, which fluctuate, the core price of goods remained flat. The dramatic decline in energy prices has kept inflation low for the year as well. Consumers are now paying 21% less for gasoline than a year ago. The Federal Reserve says its target rate for annual inflation is 2%. The U.S. is running at about three-quarters that rate. And in many countries in Europe, prices are declining. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Wall Street closed higher by the bell today, snapping a five-day losing streak. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gaining 190 points to close at 17,511. That's better than a 1% jump. This is NPR.
The Valley of the Sun is a phrase associated with the Phoenix area, but many in the business community would like the term Silicon Desert to catch on. That would be an indication that the role of high-tech jobs in the area's economy is growing. Chris Camacho is interim president of the Greater Phoenix Economic Council, or GPEC. Camacho says some progress has been made, but there's more to be done.
Most people think technology jobs are in the earlier stage innovation space, generally launched around angel investment and venture capital investment. And so in that regard, our position's dramatically improving. Relative to peer markets, we're projected to see about a 14 to 15% growth in the information communication technology sector over the next 5 years. And against peer markets, that's much higher than the Western U.S. average and about five times higher than the national average. If you're looking at kind of more stable legacy industries where technologies are embedded, that is where we're continuing to be competitive, albeit there's some global challenges in competition and advanced manufacturing practices that have forced a lot of those jobs overseas and to other lower-cost markets.
Chris, let's come back to that issue of angel investors. What are the factors that you're seeing that would give the Valley a chance to turn this around that's making you think and making the numbers think and the projectors think that we are going to be a leader in this?
Well, we're seeing, in the last 5 years, really, a major growth in the incubation centers and the acceleration models, co-working spaces. That's been happening very rapidly over, again, the last 5 years. And generally what happens is, once you see, more ideas generated, more companies being launched, the follow-on capital aligns itself with those new ventures. And so with ASU's investment, heavy investment in supporting their own researchers and also students, the community college providing better infrastructure, enhanced infrastructure to support the labor needs of these companies, notwithstanding the fact that we're seeing a lot of California influence on our market where a number of these innovators, and even companies for that matter, are locating to Phoenix and the metro market because of the low tax position and ability to access the right type of talent to scale these technology companies.
Chris, since you mentioned California, one of the things that has been said is an advantage for California, certainly when we think about Western states, is the strength of their university and college system. When it comes to really becoming a great place for tech jobs or any other industry, there's that feeling there has to be that foundation that has been built that is strong enough to almost be that support system when companies get here. Do you feel like we're on the right track there?
I would say we're a much younger market than certainly the Bay Area, where you've had well over 100 years of rooted emphasis in post-secondary education and applied research, anchored by Berkeley and Stanford and other schools. Arizona is making major strides in that capacity as we've really enhanced our applied research in the market and certainly within the university systems. And now we're really at a crossroads where we can continue to heavily invest in post-secondary institutions, and also the applied research that is really tied to a lot of our legacy industries like aerospace and defense, the semiconductor industry, advanced electronics. If you look at the last 20 years of the evolution of the innovation sector, we are considered one of the top markets for innovation.
Can you give me an idea of where we're at in terms of the venture capital that's being raised here, and then the venture capital that the level that you think it would be really nice to get to be really competitive?
The venture capital model year over year shifts pretty dramatically in Arizona, and that's really constituted by the fact that you have a number of companies across broad industries that have heavy capital requirements, generally in heavy machining type companies, and then you have the lighter capital infrastructure needed to scale ICT companies, software companies. And so I would say that that's really aligned well with what my comments on the post-secondary sector, where we're seeing dramatic improvements over the last 5 years. And as we continue to see the overarching growth of that sector and the new ideas being generated, the capital will follow those ideas. Again, we're steadily improving, but we're still in the middle of the pack relative to the top 50 states in venture capital activity.
Chris Camacho is interim president of the Greater Phoenix Economic Council, GPEC. Chris, thank you for the time.
Thank you very much, Steve.
We'll be right back.
Outdated bridges and roads all around the country need upgrades, but federal funds haven't kept pace with the demand. That's left the private sector and local and state governments to pick up the slack. And as KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block reports, that trend is now even expanding to border crossings.
The border town of Douglas in eastern Arizona is small, and so is its border crossing.
As you can see, it's very tight, it's very inefficient.
I visited recently with business leaders Oscar Valdosola and Carlos Fernandez. These guys spend a lot of time anxiously waiting for goods to make it through here. And Fernandez says the delays have been getting worse. Traffic is up 30% from 5 years ago.
It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. The line of trucks go on for quite some distance.
We're standing on the Arizona side, looking through the fence at a traffic jam on the Mexican side.
They're not going to cross before 5 o'clock.
The crossing is too narrow, says Vildosola, especially for oversized mining equipment en route to mines south of the border.
In the past, we've had pieces of equipment that don't fit through the door. So we had to hire cranes coming from Tucson or Phoenix and lift those pieces across the fence and set them in Mexico.
Not exactly a vision of efficient 21st century trade. David Murphy is with Customs and Border Protection's Tucson office.
We have ports of entry around the country, like Douglas, that are over 70 years old and do not meet the needs of the public in terms of trade or traffic.
But Murphy says there isn't money in the federal budget to keep up with all the needed renovations. So his agency has started a new program that lets outside interests raise money for these upgrades. It's known as the Donation Acceptance Program.
This allows private entities, public entities, or cities to actually come in and partner with us to build or improve facilities.
And this is where the city of Douglas comes in. Its mayor, Danny Ortega, submitted the city's proposal to be one of these partners. He says residents in both Douglas and Agua Prieta on the Mexican side are frustrated with the overworked border crossing.
Even going to birthday parties in Mexico could take half a day to get back and forth when it's only, you know, a few blocks away.
His proposal will renovate the current crossing and build an additional commercial crossing just for trucks. And so where exactly are we driving around right now?
Okay, we're about 5 miles west of Douglas, about a mile off the main highway.
Ortega and I drive out to see the proposed site for the new truck crossing.
This is the city property where we're willing to donate to the federal government for our new port of entry.
It's 80 acres of desert right next to the border fence.
The Mexican landowner just south of us is also willing to donate his lands to the federal Mexican government in order to get this port project completed.
Ortega had to get counterparts in the Mexican city of Agua Prieta, plus state governments on both sides of the border and the Mexican federal government to all agree on the proposal. Ortega believes a new commercial border crossing will create jobs.
It doesn't look like much now, but I'm hoping 2-3 years from now it's going to be a real nice commercial area for Douglas.
But first, the city needs to pay for the port's construction, upwards of $37 million. The city plans to raise the money through bonds and possibly toll revenues or through private investors. It also hopes to convince the federal government to pay rent for the port facility. Robert Puentes with the Brookings Institute says these partnerships are all part of the new reality.
There isn't a lot of money coming from Washington anytime soon. There's really no cavalry coming to help.
Puentes says that means creative solutions must be on the table to pay for infrastructure projects, even though border crossings may seem like an unlikely candidate for outsourcing.
As debt and dysfunction kind of is the name of the game here in Washington, doesn't mean we're not going to do things here in America. We're just going to find different ways to do them.
Customs and Border Protection has received 7 applications from potential partners for the new donation acceptance program. It will decide by the middle of this year which ones it will accept and whether the Douglas port will be one of them. Jude Joffe Block, KJZZ News, reporting from Douglas, Arizona.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody along with Steve Goldstein. If you're driving in the North Valley this afternoon, be aware of an accident, I-17 northbound at Union Hills that has the left lanes blocked. A bit further south, I-17 northbound at Camelback, an accident blocks the shoulder. Look for clear skies tonight across the valley, overnight lows in the mid-40s. It's sunny and 70 degrees at KJZZ at 248.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, offering a gourmet game plan with gridiron subs, party platters, USDA prime steaks, fresh-made guacamole, and craft beers. 10 Valley locations can be found at AJsFineFoods.com.
It's among a number of buildings in downtown Phoenix that dates to the early 20th century. It's also been the home of several of Arizona's most famous leaders. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us more about it.
The Masonic Temple in downtown Phoenix has been sitting on the corner of 4th Avenue and Monroe Street for nearly 90 years. It is considered the most active Masonic temple in Arizona. Did you know the building was considered for demolition in the 1990s?
The three sides that are around us right now, they wanted this, the fourth side. They wanted it for parking garage.
Andrew Warianka is the building manager. He's been part of the organization and in the building since the 1960s. He's also a local lodge master.
The city of Phoenix wanted to eminent domain the building. And they had actually voted on it and came here with their paperwork. And we said, well, we've already got our paperwork.
You beat them to the punch?
Beat them to the punch. Otherwise, this would have been ground level.
The three-story rectangular-shaped structure was built in 1926. This is a 46,000-square-foot building and the home of several lodges. Its primary group is Arizona Lodge No. 2. On the ground level is the dining area and a 4,000-square-foot auditorium. The second floor was created as the temple's main lobby. And the elevator is original, small, and with a sliding gate door.
Third floor are meeting rooms.
Freemasons is a fraternal group initially founded in the Middle Ages. Warianka says the purpose lies on the foundation of making good men better persons, serving its community and charitable organizations in various ways. Each room is used by specific lodges, and they're identified by a color. The blue room is the home lodge's meeting area. The gold room is where the ladies of the Freemasons meet.
You can know what the name of this room is.
The red room.
Yes.
This is where the York Rite hosts their gatherings. Warianka says Arizona Lodge No. 2 was actually chartered by the California Grand Lodge in 1879. At the time, Arizona did not have one. By 1900, the Arizona Lodge decided it was time to find a home here.
Along about that time, we started looking around the valley. When we settled on this, there were actually four or five locations that we had looked at, all in the downtown area. And they settled on this.
The Masonic Temple is listed on the Phoenix Historic Property Register. Preservationists say the building is important to Valley history, not only for its neoclassic style architecture, but also for its proximity to local and state buildings. They say Freemasons have been integral to the growth of the area because many of its members have been leaders of our state, including people like Barry Goldwater, members of the Lewis family, and John Rhodes. Just to name a few. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
If you know something we should know that's not a no-no, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
The Pistoleros have been a fixture of the Valley music scene for more than 20 years and is probably best known for its role in Tempe's jangle pop scene of the 90s. Now the band is releasing its first album in 10 years. It's called Shine.
The Pistoleros are fronted by two brothers, Mark and Lawrence Zubia. While they are very close, both as brothers and collaborators, they were estranged for some time, while Lawrence was experiencing some severe substance abuse issues. And even though the pair put out music during that 10-year period, for many fans, this new Pistoleros album represents a big transition, both symbolically and stylistically. We invited Mark and Lawrence Zubia into the KJZZ studios to play a tiny desert concert, and we began by asking Mark how he defines artistic growth.
For me, it's defined by being able to capture that inspiration and then use the craft you learned to form that inspiration. And that's what I noticed that for both of us, that we're able to do that more succinctly now.
Well, do you know when you've nailed it better now than you used to or no?
Sometimes and other times, no. That's why it's kind of nice that Lawrence and I work together because I rely on him for melodies and lyrics. And I think speaking for you, Lawrence, I think he relies on me for maybe some musical guitar, you know.
Arrangements.
So we edit each other.
Yeah.
And so to answer your question, I don't always know exactly. So that's why it's good to have a writing partner.
I mean, was it a matter of complementing each other's strengths or just came together? I mean, as far as when you write lyrics together, are you actually writing together, or is that feeling what you guys just said about arrangement, lyrics, where do they intersect?
Doing this record, there was a lot of clarity and a lot of those questions were answered for me. We do have a method, and both Mark and I write separately, like bring in whole songs separately, and they're almost done, and then Mark does what he said, arranges them for me, and maybe I'll clean up Mark's lyrics. But then there's also the songs that are only barely started, and we both bring those in, and then those compliments come into play at full force. Mark will really show me where he thinks I was really kind of going with the idea, and I will kind of figure out the lyric and the melody. But it's really succinct, as Mark said now. It's working really well now.
Mark, when you play live for an audience, how do you combine the fact that you're going to play the songs they know, you also want to make sure they understand the sound the direction is going in now? Are you able to enjoy that and not resent that?
Yeah, no, I enjoy it. I appreciate everything that's happened to us and don't shy away from it at all. But, of course, want to introduce, you know, new songs that may not be what they're expecting or what we're expecting. So to open the channels a little bit wider is always welcomed.
If I might add to that,
there's
sort of a beauty in everything, you know? There's a beauty in the fact that we didn't have two really huge hits and that we can't come out from behind those hits, you know? Like, that's it, show's over, you know, because we played our hit. With the people that have followed us here in Tempe for the last 20 years, super loyal people, and it seems like we can play almost anything quality that we've written and get kind of the same reaction. Certain people have certain favorites, but there was no, like, a quintessential radio hit that we have to
live up to
or come out from behind.
Or emulate over and over again.
Lo siento, yo no sé. I'm hoping we can slip away. Under the August sky tonight, between the sheets and bright daylight, I'm hoping we can find our way, yeah. Yo no sé. Yo no sé. Lo mismo otra vez. Lo mismo todo, yo no sé. Between that we create ourselves, you and I and no one else. I'm hoping we can find our way, yeah. Yo no sé. Yo no sé. Yo no sé.
you're no saint.
When you guys were able to get back together after that down period, from a musical standpoint, I get that you guys popped back together. But from a personal standpoint, did you like each other again? Did you really want to spend time together?
Yes, definitely.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I was ready. The time was right. The waters had calmed, and it was the right time to do it. But nobody could have told me a month in advance or 6 months in advance that it was going to happen. It was just seeing him and knowing that it was time.
Okay, last thing, and this might be the same answer for both of you, but Lawrence, how are you going to define success? Not necessarily of this album, but success of the rebonding of the brothers as you move forward.
Making a couple more records. Making a pretty straight-up country-western album. And then maybe a
folkish
Jayhawks meets the Zubia Brothers type of record.
And then another Pistoleros record.
Yep.
You know, just keep doing it. As far as success goes, I get to do what I love to do, so I feel successful.
I'm concerned that I'm not concerned. Not okay. That I'm not okay. I'm ashamed that I'm not ashamed. I'm concerned that I'm not concerned. I will go where darkness leads. Move among tramps and thieves.
The Pistoleros CD release show is tomorrow night at Last Exit Live in Phoenix. You can see video of Mark and Lawrence Zubia of the Pistoleros playing from the new album Shine by visiting theshow.kjzz.org. And if you're in a band that would like to play a Tiny Desert concert at the KJZZ studios, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
Lots of good stuff going on this weekend. If you're into running very long distances, the Rock and Roll Marathon could be for you. There's the standard 26.2-mile race. You can also do a half marathon. Lots of live music. Either way, it starts at 7:50 on Sunday morning.
And if you want to laugh this weekend, the Cosmonaut Sketch Comedy Troupe is in Glendale tonight and tomorrow at the Brelby Theater Company in Glendale. Showtime, 7:30.
Also, Barrett Jackson ends this weekend. Also, the Russo and Steel Auto Auction end this weekend as well. Those are both in the North Valley.
Today's edition of the show is produced by our senior producers, Jimmy Jenkins and Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Annika Klein. Tracy Greer and Maria Springs are our digital team. The news director is Al Macias. The executive producer is the uncanny one, John Hoban.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know what is on your playlist, maybe the Pistoleros or something else. Send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great weekend. It's 3 o'clock.